Okay, we're going to take your phone calls now this hour with Nick Redfern as we talk about his research book, The Real Men in Black. Your calls and perhaps your stories. Maybe you've been visited. Check in with us on Coast to Coast AM. What's the link, Nick, between the Men in Black and Ouija boards?
Yeah, this is probably one of the weirder aspects of the entire mystery, George. One of the people I interviewed for the book was an Anglican priest named Ray Beauchesne, who lives in Lincoln, Nebraska. And as well as being an Anglican priest, Ray's also a former state director for MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. He used to run the Nebraska chapter of MUFON. And he, so in other words, he's someone who has a background in the Christian church and also in ufology. And Ray has deeply dug into the UFO mystery and the Men in Black mystery, even to the point of he actually met once Albert Bender and was in touch with Gray Barker also for a number of years. And Ray has come to the conclusion that, the, in his view, the Men in Black have literally like demonic origins. That's his firm conclusion. And one of the things he points out and notes is that a lot of the people who had involvement with the Men in Black or been visited or interacted with them have also been involved in the occult. For example, Albert Bender used Ouija boards. Claudia Cunningham, who I mentioned at the Albany Cemetery story, her friend Linda, who had the experience, she was a user of Ouija boards. And Mary Robinson, who saw this weird man in black outside her apartment in Jersey City that Tim Beckley photographed, she was a big fan of Ouija boards. And there are other cases where, as Ray points out, that people who've had visitations to the Men in Black, when the MIB experiences have occurred, either in the immediate wake or at the very time of the encounters, there have been outbreaks of poltergeist activity in the homes of the people. Now, of course, this sounds highly bizarre and controversial, but there's no doubt that it is an aspect of the phenomenon, you know, and that's why, you know, some people like Ray have gone down the path suggesting that it's, you know, it's far more occult-based than it is sort of flesh and blood and physical. Mm-hmm. My own take on it is that I do think there's an aspect of this to it, but what I'm more inclined to believe is that this is sort of another aspect of the Men in Black mystery. You know, I don't think it can account for all the Men in Black stories. I think what it does demonstrate is that we have at least three or four strands of MIB, all sort of under the MIB banner, but some of them actually having wildly different origins. You know, we could actually be looking at government people, aliens, time travelers, and something paranormal that have, you know, the UFO community has had a tendency to put them all under one banner, when really, you know, we should be looking at them, each case on its own merits, and they may have wildly different origins.
Well, that's a good point. What have you found to be some of your strangest cases that you've come across?
Well, you know, I think everything about the Men in Black certainly smacks of high strangeness. I think more than anything else, you know, it's the sort of the collective ways and means by which the MIB appear and vanish. I think possibly, you know, the oddest thing of all, and I think this is a theory that has a lot of merit, is the theory of tulpas, which has been offered for the Men in Black. The tulpa, the idea is, you know, that human mind, if it focuses on one particular image, can kind of externalize that image and sort of give birth to like a mind monster. Some people have speculated, you know, that's what the MIB are. You know, they're sort of the image of the black-suited, intimidating person is sort of deeply rooted in the human consciousness, and we actually kind of, you know, give birth to them. They stride right out of our imagination into the real world. Highly controversial. Certainly one of the other most fascinating for me, but equally controversial aspects and certainly strange aspects of the mystery is that particularly in England and America, when the MIB are seen driving these old-fashioned cars, that there are a number of reports on record where the cars just seem to literally, and I do mean literally, dematerialized, as if, you know, they've just vanished into nothingness. Now, again, that sounds highly bizarre, but everything about the Men in Black is bizarre. But we get reports, you know, little-known cases from England that really have, you know, only been told from one friend to another, and then somebody's leaked it out eventually to the UFO community, paralleling very closely similar stories to the United States. You know, I mean, that again takes the MIB stories at a very strange path. You know, they're not only driving old-fashioned cars. These cars seem to have like a limited lifespan. You know, one minute here, they're here, and the next minute, they're literally gone.
Well, that's a good point. Let's take some calls here, Nick. Okay. Tim in Phoenix, Arizona. Probably brutally hot there, Tim. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Today at 111, we're officially in the hell zone.
Oh.
Forgive my voice. I have a little congestion here tonight. Some time ago, but this is back in the late 70s when I was still in high school, my cousins and I, we'd frequently go out for coffee after church or whatever and talk about UFOs. And there was one night when we were sitting in the booth, and I was looking out the window to the street as I was telling somebody, the group there, about the Betty and Barney Hill case.
Mm-hmm.
And just as I got to the point where I was describing the aliens, this fairly tall figure, very skinny, walking very stiffly in a black suit and a long, skinny black tie, walks right down the... Oh, I'm so scared. I got goosebumps just thinking about it now. And it was walking right in front of me as I'm looking out the window. And everyone looked at me, and I'm aghast. It's like the wind was knocked out of me. They looked. They totally freaked out. And what this being had on, it was a person, okay? I think it was a prank, but it was a weird coincidence. Or it could have been another manifestation of the way that the men in black work. There's somebody had put on a styrofoam head, you know, that holds a wig, put on a nylon stocking over that, and put on a very long suit to put it over their head so that they look like a real long, real tall alien, you know, in a black suit. And this is before the Men in Black phenomenon took off in the movies and so forth. But we couldn't believe it. It's just a weird coincidence of that. And I just wanted to throw that one out as another possible way that they, what people stop talking about these
things. Well, it's interesting. Halloween's coming a little early. Tim, hey, thanks. Yeah, Phoenix is getting blasted away. You know what? What kind of a person, though, would be dumb enough to run around in a Bigfoot costume or dressed up like a Men in Black, you know? I wouldn't.
Well, no, I mean, you know, certainly Bigfoot, you might get yourself shot in the woods, you know,
that's right.
That may well happen one day, you know. But, you know, the Men in Black, again, we have these questions. I mean, it's an intriguing story, you know. We do get cases like this, some of which we can resolve, you know, in down-to-earth terms. Others just still elude us, you know, 40, 50 years onwards.
Next up, we go to Marty in Charleston, West Virginia, east of the Rockies. Hey, Marty, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, are you there?
Yes.
Okay. I got cut off last time. I got to meet Frank Edwards, who wrote Stranger Than Science and UFO Serious Business.
Cool. Yeah. He was a classic giant in his day.
He was, and my dad had a bookstore. So I got to listen in on all the conversations that day when he was signing autographs. And he told my dad, after we closed the store, about a female reporter in her 20s that had warned him that she was being followed by these strange men in black, and that he was going to investigate the Braxton County Monster incident, which is in West Virginia, and she told him not to because strange things were starting to happen. Well, then it turned out not too long after that, after she warned him, she died suddenly of a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
And she was in her 20s.
Hmm.
Which is kind of strange.
No, that is. I mean, you do actually get a number of stories like that where, you know, people have done research into people in the UFO community who've died under questionable circumstances.
Absolutely.
And, you know, there's sort of a growing body of reports. Now, I mean, you know, to what extent we're able to actually, you know, demonstrate a direct connection with the MIB, you know, that's open to debate. But, you know, there have been a number of cases where I think, like, for example, Maurice Jessup, who was one of the big players on the UFO subject in the 50s, his death is still seen by many researchers as highly suspicious. So, you know, I think, you know, although it's sort of an ominous, disturbing area, I think, you know, this is actually a subject that we we really should be digging more into. You know, the idea that the threat level goes from not just intimidation, but, you know, if you get really close, you know, is the ultimate step taken to sort of, you know, prevent you getting any further, you know, and I wouldn't rule it out.
All right, let's go to Christopher in Los Angeles. He's up with us, first-time caller. Christopher, hi.
Hi, guys. How you doing? Thank
Good.
You for taking my call. I appreciate it. I wanted to talk to you guys about an experience that I had back in 2005, and I heard that, George, you're familiar with Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville, and one night after studying with my friend Jason, he and I was dropping back home at Cougar Village, which is an apartment complex for students that's dorms, basically. And it's in a really thick wooded area. And it was about 3:30 in the morning. It was pretty late. And I dropped him off. I'm driving back. And all of a sudden, out of my left-hand view, I saw this really bright object. And I didn't know what it was. It was really bright, like a star. Sorry, I'm kind of nervous because it was a really intense experience. And this object was glowing. I was on North University Drive. I made a left, and this object came up from above the tree line, started following me, and followed me for maybe about half a mile to a mile on North University Drive where it meets Old Pogue. And I'm sitting there smacking myself in the face three times. I was like, thought I was hallucinating or something. It's clearly real. I came to a four-way stop, and this object went from probably what was 45, 50 miles an hour to, I mean, honestly, 10,000. It just left the atmosphere in a split second. Raced home, called my friend that I just dropped off, called my girlfriend at the time, and, you know, no one believed me. So I filed a report on, I can't remember what website it was like a UFO.
Probably the National UFO Reporting Center.
That I tried to find the most official one that I could find.
Filed
a report. A day later, I get a visit at my front door from a man dressed in black.
Interesting.
With a hat, really weird looking eyes. And he asked me a bunch of questions, you know, my name, family history, if there was any like case of psychosis, if I was crazy, basically.
Did he identify himself, Christopher?
He didn't give his name. He just said that, I can't remember what agency that he said he was from. My phone's going to die.
He made it sound official though, didn't he? All right. Well, we're getting out of range here with you. Have you ever been threatened, Nick, at all in your work by any of these?
No, people often ask me that, you know, having sort of written the book. I haven't. The closest I've sort of ever come to anything like this is that occasionally, you know, I've interviewed people where, you know, they might have emailed me and said, you know, I've got a story to tell you. And I'd be like, well, you know, yeah, great. I'm going to be away for a couple of days. Can I give you a call in, say, 3 or 4 days when I get back? You know, we can chat about it. And then when I call them, you know, the whole tone's changed, that they're quite reticent and reluctant. So this has happened perhaps on, you know, a dozen occasions over the course of 15 years or so, where it's clear that the person's opened up and said, well, you know, after we first spoke, that, you know, I had this weird phone call where somebody suggested it would be a good idea not to talk with you about this experience. And he actually put people off speaking. And so, you know, in other words, I've not been intimidated or anything like that. You know, I've not had that sort of visitation. But people I've been planning to interview, it's almost like somebody's intervened to dissuade them from speaking, which, of course, you know, sort of begs all sorts of questions about telephone monitoring programs and all sorts of things along those lines. You know, when you know, secret surveillance of people in the UFO community, et cetera.
I never thought of them as being demonic, but since you've brought it up, Nick, it might make sense as a strong possibility, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, to me, the demonic angle is an interesting one, but I think, you know, it depends how you define what, you know, demons are, you know, or aren't. You know, are we talking about something that's literally demonic, or are we talking about an entity that we don't fully understand that resides in some other realm or, you know, quasi-dimension, and we give it like a demonic terminology as a means to understand what it may be. You know, I think, but there's absolutely no doubt that when you look into this mystery, you know, you do find these sort of occult overtones with poltergeist activity and people using Ouija boards who've been visited. And, you know, it does take you down some very dark and winding and ominous pathways, you know, that you don't initially think you're going to go down. You think it's going to be just government people flashing ID cards and saying, hey, you know, just cut that UFO research out. It goes far, far beyond that.
All right, let's go to Astatula, Florida, and it's Thomas on Coast to Coast. Hi, Thomas.
Yes, sir. One of the things that causes me, why in black? Why not in white? As in demonic in black, angelic in white? Different,
yeah, good point.
Entities, are, you know, the source and the reason why they tend to conceal themselves as they do. And also in the movies, so they say, is that they wipe your mind clear of any experience you may have had. And the little bit that we know that we're babbling about this evening is cause concern of what really happens when we're not around. Do we remember? Is that the purpose of them even contacting you? You follow kind of what I'm saying? I'm very intrigued about it. Demonic, angelic, white, black, what's right and what's wrong.
All right, he might have a point there, Nick.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, this is an interesting angle. You know, the sort of the archetypal sort of shadowy dark figure, you know, is something that extends throughout history. It's not just a modern day thing. And, you know, sort of a black intimidating suit, the hat, the sunglasses, you know, by default, it is all intimidating. And, you know, you make a valid point where you talk about sort of the angelic white good angle and then the sort of the ominous man in black who's, you know, defined as being definitively evil. I mean, to give you an example, you can go back sort of the 15, 1600s when you had certain alchemists, you know, trying to turn base metal into precious metals. You can find a number of old stories of alchemists from that period who said, you know, they would get a visit late at night from this strange, ominous black-dressed figure who would warn them about the hazards of, you know, digging into alternative science like alchemy, you know, and they would appear and then just again vanish into the night. And there was this sort of air of, you know, like an evil presence about them. And, you know, you do have to wonder, are we looking at sort of, you know, left and right hand, like a good and evil type phenomena? You know, I can't rule it out.
Well, all right, stick with us. We're going to come back, Nick, in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take final phone calls here. We'll go to San Bernardino, Yellow Springs in Ohio, Atlanta, Georgia, the state of Washington, and much more as we talk with Nick Redfern, the real Men in Black on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. Don't touch your dial. And as I mentioned on our next Coast to Coast program, we are going to be talking about 2012 when we come back. Final phone calls with Nick Redfern on Coast to Coast AM. And here we go, back with Nick Redfern. You'll final calls as well on Coast to Coast AM. With these strange stories, surprising stories, was it difficult for you, Nick, to get the research done, or did it come easy?
I would say, you know, when I sort of got into it deeply, George, it probably did come fairly easy because I found, you know, the more doors I was able to open and sort of take people into, you know, sort of my confidence, then that if they had stories to tell of other people they knew, they would speak to them for me and say, you know, hey, this guy's, you know, writing about it and he's going to treat it seriously. Do you want to speak to him? So, you know, that worked well. But I will be the first to admit, you know, when you're dealing with sort of the historical angle going back 50, 60 years, then, you know, we need to try and get insight from the people who are still around who were there, which is precisely why I interviewed people like Jim Moseley and Brad Steiger, because, you know, it's incredibly important when we're dealing with 40-year-old cases or 50-year-old cases in when it comes to people like Albert Bender, or even nearly 60 years old now. You know, we need the insight of the people who were there. I mean, you know, the witnesses, the people who had the recollections. That's why, you know, I spent so much time extensively interviewing people for the book, was simply because, you know, I wasn't there. You know, those people were. They're the people who know what they're talking about. So I felt that's, you know, that was an important issue.
Well, that's absolutely true. And let's look at your personal opinion now. What do you think these people are, these things?
Okay. Well, as I said, I'm absolutely convinced that some MIB are government personnel. You know, there's no doubt about that.
But, meshing in, getting there and doing what they do. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. And I actually think they do exploit this sort of weird MIB motif and act kind of strange occasionally to cover their tracks, because it is a good camouflage. You know, it makes a person look crazy if they talk about it. So I think there is the government angle. Now, as for what these weirder men in black are, I have to be honest, I'm in sort of several minds. I think there's definitely a paranormal quality to them, but equally there seems to be like a substantial flesh and blood angle to them as well. So, you know, are we looking at entities that sort of straddle both realms, you know, or are we actually looking, as I suspect might be the case, and this sort of takes it down even more confusing pathways, that we try and pigeonhole the men in black to be this or that. Maybe it really is the case that, you know, some, as Josh Warren suggested, maybe some really are time travelers. Maybe some are demons. Yeah. Maybe some are government people. Maybe some are paranormal. Others are trickster-like entities. Perhaps, you know, it's our tendency as human beings to want to classify things in the most simplistic terms. What if we really do have like a whole menagerie of men in black that have wildly different origins and intent and reasons for sort of moving amongst us? I think that could be a possibility, you know, that we're not looking at just one or two potential origins. You know, there could be a whole, like a school of men in black, you know,
sure.
that we call them men in black, but there are a few subtle differences between the different types of phenomena.
Well, who or whatever they are, they sure do intimidate people, don't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is the one thing that really does stand out, is that they're almost like life-changing experiences for people who've had UFO encounters. You know, if you say you've seen a UFO, most people are quite interested, actually. A lot of people don't get ridiculed. But when you had the MIB experience, what it seems to do more than anything else is it has a profound psychological, a negatively psychological effect upon the person, whether it's a witness or in the case of people like Albert Bender, who's a researcher. You know, the person doesn't just feel sort of threatened and intimidated to where, you know, they don't talk about the case. It then seems to impact on other areas of their lives. You know, there are cases where people have felt too stressed to leave the house for weeks, you know, and then when they did go out, they started having panic attacks and things like that, purely and simply because of this bizarre experience. You know, the people who, they've had mail arrive late to the point where they become obsessed with watching the mailbox, you know, for the fear of the men in black are going to turn up. And I find this, although it's horrible and harrowing for the person involved, I do find it interesting that the MIB seem to have this ability to drastically affect the psychological mindset of the people they visit. And it almost seems to be, you know, they can instill it. They can amplify this sort of negativity that surrounds the person almost.
All right, back to the calls we go. We'll go to Yellow Springs, Ohio, as promised. It's Marshall's turn. Go ahead, Marshall.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good, Marshall.
Excellent. Hey, I want to applaud you, Nick. You've done a really good job. I used to be an MIB investigator myself back in the early 90s. In fact, I know Timothy Van Beckley and a few of the other people involved. But I've got some things for you might not be aware of. One, in my investigations, I found out one of the tricks that they use to seemingly disappear suddenly, like when they go around a corner. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they'll do is they will hide behind a telephone pole. Now, if you notice, a lot of times these guys are fairly skinny, right? Now, there's a way. I actually witnessed this. An individual hide behind a telephone pole. I went on the corner, didn't see anybody. It's like, where the hell did this guy go? And all of a sudden, the wind blew, and all of a sudden, the trench coat flapped out from behind the telephone pole. I'm like, okay. So, like, there's all kinds of little tricks they'll pull that are very physical, but you might not think of. Another thing, real quick, is that Josh, if you warn things, there might be time travelers. So, my research, we actually pinned it down more to this from a parallel universe. And speaking in that same vein, are you familiar with a TV show called Fringe F-R-I-N-G-E.
Yeah.
Right. Well, he noticed the observers are actually very much based on the MIB. And in particular, they look like the MIB from the Dr. Hopkins case. Are you familiar with that case?
Yes, from I am. I think 1976, when he got the visit from this sort of weird-looking MIB.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. These guys seem to be patterned after that. And another thing about the cars, real quick, have you read Jenny Randall's book on the truth behind the Men in Black?
Yes, I have, yeah.
Yeah, well, on page 176 in that book, she talks about how, and there was a particular case that was investigated by the police where the MIB had a Jaguar. It wasn't one of the older cars. It was one of the, it was like a newer model Jaguar. And, in fact, it disappeared right in front of them. And that's another reason why the cases I was interested in were the weird ones, the ones that obviously weren't government agents or whatnot. And
Marshall, let me ask you for a second here, Marshall. The hiding behind the telephone pole, for example, why would they do that? What were they trying to do?
Well, in other words, this is when they're being pursued. For example, like he gave an example where, you know, somebody's trying to follow the guy goes around the corner and he vanished, you know. They couldn't see him where he went to. That's what they do to lose you, to make you think they just disappear in the thin air, if they're on foot, that is. That's one thing you have to look out for. Try it sometime. I mean, you get a friend that's not very, you know, heavy set, and try it, and you'll find out that it can actually work. That or ducking behind a car, parked car, in between parked cars. And guys, what you do is you expect to see someone continuing down the path that they were going, like on the sidewalk or whatever, when you turn the corner. You turn a corner, and all of a sudden, wow, they're nowhere in sight. Like, where do they go? And that's the psychological rules, the rules that they will use sometimes.
Okay, great. Thanks. Good tips there,
thanks,
Nick. You never know what's...
I think some of the, as I said, I think particularly the government people, you know, they're well-versed in sort of psychological warfare and how to get out of tricky situations and cover their tracks. And, you know, I think that is, you know, certainly an aspect of the phenomenon that is logical and makes sense. You know, it's, I don't think you can answer all the questions, obviously, but I do think, you know, for the one particular category of MIB, then, you know, it does offer a logical explanation. You know, if these guys are sort of almost like military-trained, you know, commando units or whatever.
Catch a Men in Black, waterboard him, and find out what's going on.
Yeah, that would be great if we could just get hold of one, you know, just even one, and just, you know, who are you?
Let's go to Margaret, San Bernardino, California. Good morning, Margaret.
Good morning, George and Nick, and this is such a great show. Thank you for taking my call. It seems like the further along we get with technology, the more we find out so little we know. And I have a story that has bothered me for years that happened on Christmas Eve, and it was in 2001, and my dad passed away, and he was a really good guy, went to church every day, and he was, a lot of people knew him, and it was, you know, after the funeral and after everything had happened, and a few days later, my mom said, talk to Phil across the street. He has a strange story to tell you. And this was a guy who was a retired engineer, and that earlier in that day, my dad died at 6 in the evening. Earlier that day, his wife had a brain tumor, and he was waiting for an ambulance to come and get her. And they lived right across the street up an access road. So he was down at the street level waiting for the ambulance. And he told me that he saw these two men in black coats, black hats, walking down the street with a list in their hand. And this was a very small street. This was up in the mountains. So this was a small street. They knew all the neighbors. And it was so out of character. And he thought he saw his name on the list, and he said, excuse me, can I help you guys find anyone? And he looked at them, and they said, no, we're looking for somebody. And they walked right past him, and they disappeared right in front of his eyes. And he said he didn't know what it was, but to this day, I always wondered if there was a connection with my dad's passing because it was so unexpected and so immediate. I mean, he was healthy and happy, and then just boom, he was gone.
Mm. Well, this is like one of the central aspects of the Men in Black mystery, Margaret, is the fact that the MIB do turn up and they do vanish. you know, when I say vanish, I don't just mean they seem elusive. There are reports of them just literally vanishing. And I think, you know, how we explain that, I don't know. But I think the sort of the multidimensional angle is actually a very interesting one. You know, the idea that there could be multiple portals and doorways to extra dimensions, you know, and things like that, which actually quantum physics is now allowing for, you know, multiple dimensions. And I think the idea that we could have entities that have mastered the ability to sort of just zip in and out of realities and time zones is kind of a logical one, to my way of thinking anyway, to explain these sort of weirder aspects of the mystery.
Next up, Whidbey Island, Washington, Paul Stern. Paul, good morning.
Hi, George and Nick. I'm so glad I stayed up for this one. I have a very quick question. I'm fascinated by the anecdotal material regarding animals' interactions and the paranormal. So, Nick, in all your research, have you ever found any people who have told you their pets have had any strange reactions to or interactions with these MID visits? Thank you.
That's actually a very good question because, I've got a couple of cases in the book. One involved a doctor named Herbert Hopkins, who in 1976 had a really weird MIB encounter, sort of very bone-chilling one almost, one of the very creepy white character. And Hopkins said that his dog, which was like a big German shepherd, just turned tail, howled, and just raced off to one of the cupboards in the house when the MIB was invited in. And it was sort of pretty clear from the story that, you know, that the dog recognized there was something very strange about this character, not just a regular human being in a black suit. And the dog just basically stayed in the cupboard shaking until the MIB had gone. And there are a number of stories like that where the MIB don't express sort of hostility towards the animal, but the animal either shows hostility or just is just downright petrified and, you know, just wants to get away from the area. So they're clearly, I think, picking up on something, you know, where if it's just some sort of negative vibe, what it is, I don't know. But dogs particularly seem to recognize that there's something not right about the MIB.
All right, good. Bob in Atlanta, it's your turn. Go ahead, Bob. Thank you.
Hey, George, thanks very much. Sure. You got a great show. Nick, I love your work, too. I wanted to talk to you about these men in black. I'm with you. I believe that some of them may be, you know, something that we just can't get a grasp of. Because like you said at the beginning of the show, some of the people, they feel like, you know, they get some kind of uneasy, you know, creepy feeling when these things show up. And then I've heard the governor, Jesse Ventura, he had a show where he was trying to expose government conspiracies, and he said that he thought he had been followed by some men in black.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's a very prominent person. So anyway, you know, it's hard to say what these things really are. I wanted to ask you about your book, Final Events. That was an outstanding book about the government think tank on UFOs and how they pretty much came to the conclusion they were demonic. And that's what I've always felt all this stuff was. It's something to do with, you know, demons. I was just wondering, with all the research that you've done on it, you haven't came to that conclusion yourself?
Well, you know, I think it's difficult, you know, when we're sort of trying to determine what UFOs are, because, you know, when we talk about demons, you know, it's the idea that they're literal demons from hell or wherever, you know, is, I guess, a construct of Christianity. Other religions, you know, talk about jinns. You know, Islam talks about the jinn, which is sort of a benevolent or malevolent entity.
Right.
So in other words, I think, you know, a lot of how we define some of these sort of quasi-supernatural entities or whatever is dependent upon which belief system we're talking about. My personal conclusion is that I'm inclined to go down the sort of more multidimensional path rather than just literally extraterrestrial. I think I've come more and more over perhaps the last 10 years or so to the idea that the UFO phenomenon is sort of extra dimensional and it sort of coexists with us rather than necessarily, you know, somebody from point A in this particular star system coming here. But I will admit, you know, that some of the stories, you know, they do have parallels with, you know, ancient folklore, mythology, religion, you know, to where there's clearly some connection going on. But I try not to get caught up too much in belief systems to explain the nature of the phenomenon beyond the fact that I know for sure that something's interacting with us.
And other countries are getting the same kind of reports on MIBs,
yes,
aren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah.
All right, very good. Nick, I want to thank you for being on the program. And again, marvelous work with this one, The Real Men in Black.
Oh, I appreciate Nick, that, George. Thank you. And if people are interested, I'm actually speaking at the Conscious Life Expo the first weekend in October in Los Angeles.
I'll see you there, by the way. I'll see
all
you
right,
there.
Great.
So I look forward to seeing you. Nick Redfern, always a great guest and a superb researcher in the field of ufology and Men in Black, and you name it, he's one of the best. So don't forget our next program, which will be on 2012 and some of the latest episodes about that. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Ladasur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.